Thank you. And for those of you in the middle here, I will actually talk over the slides, too, to make sure that you get the points. I'll also mention, as I think will be evident, that I started my career as an EIS officer in the STD division in 1985. And what I'm going to tell you is a story of the surveillance program and how this evolved and how it's become probably one of the nation's most important antimicrobial surveillance programs. The story with gonorrhea begins after the end of World War II, but 1977, the first PPNG, many of the old-timers remember penicillinase producing Neisseria gonorrhea, the first plasmid-mediated resistance, which was high-level resistance to penicillin, was diagnosed in 1976, and there was actually large outbreaks in California and in New York City, and this is a WHO article from the New York Times on the WHO meeting to look at this. This moves on. This was actually in my grandmother's files when she died. If you look at, it's true. If you look at the middle thing, the reason it's there because basically I'm commenting on new gonorrhea fear. These are the New York Post from 30 years ago. And the headlines haven't changed very much. If you look at the one on the right, incurable new VD can strike. So resistance, and the background why the gonococcal isolate surveillance project was started is because it became very clear that the number of resistance, types of resistance was actually increasing, the proportion of patients with resistance was increasing, and we had no idea what the true story was. In 1945, you could treat gonorrhea with 50,000 units of penicillin. This increased in 1975 to 4.8 million units. This is before PPNG. And then in 1981, chromosomally-mediated gonorrhea began. Bob Komischer, who's sitting in the front, was the DIS in North Carolina involved in that outbreak. And in 1985, soon after, in my second month as an EIS officer, we reported on the first cases of plasmid-mediated tetracycline resistance. And this is before anything that we have now is becoming very clear that the situation was becoming very confusing. So there was a national, 1986, there was a documented national need for evidence-based for surveillance to guide evidence-based treatment guidelines. There were also no standardized methods for diagnosis of antimicrobial resistance. We surveyed the 50 public health labs and got 53 different types of testing, which is true. And ceftriaxone was just recommended as an option for treatment, but it was very clear that oral quinolones were on the horizon. They were in clinical trials, and they were approved in 1989, and azithromycin was being developed, and we needed to get a handle on this. So the idea was, let's set up a surveillance program which can identify gonococcal isolates from all over the country and systematically evaluate antimicrobial resistance. The principles of this were having standardized laboratory procedures, using a regional laboratory approach with periodic quality assurance. There were clearly defined resistance definitions, clearly to the point that sometimes they would change, but at least they would change consistently across the country, and that there was a systematic collection of isolates, usually the first 20 or 25 isolates, usually males, because you could identify males presumptively and tell the lab this is the one you need to save, and there's been arguments over the years, are these different than females? And I think most of the data shows that they're pretty good representations of what's going on. Now, this is the current version. There have been multiple maps, and you can see that there's clinical sites which are in yellow and five regional labs. There used to be one in Baltimore, and he moved up, our clinical laboratory director moved up to Boston recently. And you can see that, actually, the other thing you can see is that the clinical sites are predominantly on the coasts. There are some in the Midwest, but they're predominantly on the coast, and that was actually by design. It was based on design because it was known that the PPNGs and those, the original resistance organisms, were all coming from Asia. And this has actually turned out to be a consistent theme throughout this, and you'll see data later. And we reported on the initial program in 1987. So how do you start a project at 25 sites, 4 labs, and stand it up in a year and get data into the MMWR in a year? So the answer is only collect 9 pieces of information. And the other question, and those of you who know, since I'm being recorded, I won't say why. And the other reason is having incredible program support. And this happened because of program support, and the DIS program managers at the center and the field wanted this to happen and implemented it. The impact is we collect over 5,000 isolates a year based on data which Liz Taroni provided to me earlier this week. There's 155,000 isolates with their associated data in the database. This is one of the largest antimicrobial resistance databases which exists. The number of elements has increased above 9 because now it's an official kosher program. It's also been adopted by, the system has been adopted, and the approach has been adopted by Canada, by the UK, which is GRASP. They call it, the EU has a program, Africa is implementing a program, and the US military has implemented programs very similar to this as well. The epidemiological impact is that this program has been very useful in identifying new determinants. This quinolone resistance, the fixine resistance, and azithromycin resistance has evolved. The identification of these organisms has largely occurred through identification of subclinically important isolates through surveillance, not by treatment failures. So this is where isolates have been found, where they're clinically important increases in the MICs, but not where people are coming back for treatment. That's important because this has allowed us to stay ahead of the curve in terms of treatment guidelines. Similarly, the system has consistently showed that isolates resistant, reduced antimicrobial susceptibility starts in Hawaii and California and moves east. This is probably due to sources in Asia. We've also seen changes in the behavioral patterns of people with gonorrhea over the past 30 years with an increased proportion of MSM. We've also been able to use this to monitor treatment patterns. And those of you who come to the STD treatment guidelines know that the gonorrhea discussions have been the shortest because there's data to actually guide the discussion as opposed to having experts opine where there is a data void. Where there's a data void, experts can opine all they want. Where there's data exists, basically the decisions are pretty clear, just the experts put their stamp of approval on it. Here are some of the data. This is from 1988 through 1997 when we began. In red and yellow is PPNG, plasma-mediated penicillin resistance. Blue is tetracycline resistance, and yellow are the combined. And you can see that plasma-mediated resistance was a very substantial issue in the late 80s and early 90s, but PPNG went down in large part because penicillin therapy went away. Now, it didn't go down to zero, but this shows in large part a response to treatment. Here are the proportion of data on men who have sex with men. I'm obligated by the arrangement that I have with Liz and the GIST program to point out that the 2015 data are preliminary. But you can see that right now about 40% of patients diagnosed with gonorrhea diagnosed in STD clinics in the program are MSM. This was much compared to about 5% in 1988. This is not a reporting change. This is a true change and really has implications for large national programs, including HIV prevention. Here we have showing that the proportion, another pattern that we've seen, the proportion of men of isolates that are cipro-resistant. You see cipro-resistance starts in 1999-2000 and rapidly increases to peaking out in 2006 with a much larger proportion among MSM. So this is another consistent pattern. Antibiotic resistance occurs preferentially in MSMs and in people coming from the West Coast, with Hawaii being the bold blue line, California being the dotted line, the rest of the United States lagging by about 4 or 5 years. And Baltimore lags even further behind that. Being a true STD person, I take my family to the hot spots. This is a visit with these are my two daughters in Hawaii in 2003. You see the U.S. Arizona Memorial behind. That way, another way to write off a business trip. But the important part is that here we have, in 2004, this treatment guideline directive published in the MMWR is one of the first treatment guideline recommendations which were made on surveillance data prior to treatment failure. That is a very important public health accomplishment. And I think that's something that we don't have in a lot of other areas of infectious disease. If we look at cephalosporins, and I'm going to go about 2 minutes over because I've been trying to talk over the slides for the masses in the middle. If you go over to look at cephalosporins, you see in 1997, there was one isolate with 0.5 microgram MIC, and in 2007, the majorities were 0.008. When we started, however, it was 0.001, 0.002. So we began to see creep. This is an article which was published in 2013 about increases in cefixime resistance. We see here that cefixime resistance really increased again in the West, in the blue line, in the dotted line demonstrating men who have sex with men in other parts of the country. We saw similar directives on cefixime treatment prior to treatment failure showing up in the clinics, first in MSMs, then in the West Coast, then nationally. And we see also, since the directives have occurred, cefixime MICs have remained pretty stable across the country with minimal impact and changes over the past few years. Now, how does this tie into what's going on? And I think, where do I see the next level of interest and investigation in this? You have this enormous collection of isolates, and you have this enormous collection of data. And how do we make some sense out of this? Well, I think one of the first steps in this area, besides the phenotypic, has been identifying the genotypic distribution of disease. And Yonatan Grodin's group at Harvard, and Yonatan was a recipient of a Young Investigator Award, I believe, 2 or 3 years ago, has taken isolates which are cefixime resistant and actually mapped out the genomes and shown how the genomic clades, the individual isolates, have spread throughout the United States and how they've actually formed basically a large social network. So therefore, application of genomic techniques to surveillance data to identify outbreaks or spread of a resistant organism. So we've done this on small scales with enterics and other areas, but on large scales, this is one of the first settings where this has been done. Similarly, we have isolates, gonococcal isolates, with decreased susceptibility to azithromycin. Azithromycin is not widely used for GC therapy, but it's occasionally used. Obviously, we use it a lot for chlamydia. We saw a bump up again in 2014-15 with azithromycin. Similarly, very much higher rates in MSMs. And this is actually one of the things that, again, the same group at Harvard did. This article was published last week, has mapped out the azithromycin genome patterns. I'm not going to go into this because of time, but the azithromycin genome patterns in these organisms coming from multiple different places. So again, here we have an opportunity to actually investigate and understand what's going on with these bugs. Finally, the program has been very useful in monitoring treatment. You can see in 1988, ceftriaxone on the left was the most widely used. Ciprofloxacin going out towards in the middle 90s until 2005, where it starts to decrease in that big blue thing. Ofloxacin in purple is a similar drug. Cefixime in the tan, and then we see ceftriaxone 125, and this is up to 2011. And with the changes in recommendations, we see now almost all treatments between ceftriaxone 250. This is actually showing that the impact that our treatment guidelines are having on clinical therapy now, admittedly STD clinics, which is our audience, but on clinical therapy. So in sum, I'd like to, again, summarize that gonorrhea, as a result of this sort of surveillance program and the collated data on antibiotic resistance, I think this helped GC make it into the big leagues, into this six-carb priority organisms. I believe also after a very, very long latency period, this program is seen as a prototype surveillance network. I mean, for a long time, nobody in the central CDC office really mentioned this. You had to remind them. The CARB initiatives, however, I think this is a mixed bag. I think the GIST program has really worked wonderfully for 30 years, and now we're seeing major changes because of increased funding and changes in the structure and expansion, and I'm not sure where this is going to go, and I think we'll have to see what happens and whether we're still able to collect the same types of data with the fidelity that it was. The data that was collected in this program had a major focus on quality improvement programs. When we run out of antibiotics, you go back to 1908, and it says, this instrument, when introduced into the urethra, can be expanded at will, the degree of expansion being indicated by a pointer on a dial. Those of you who are seeing anybody, any women who've just broken up with a boyfriend, this may look very attractive. Finally, this project started as a dream in 1986 when I was an EIS officer, and really happened because of the vision of four people. Unfortunately, none of these are with us anymore. Russ Alexander was the head of the epidemiology research branch in the STD branch and was one of my mentors. And was a really remarkable epidemiologist. Ward Cates was the head of the STD division. Jack Kirby and Mark Schrader were the program leaders and who really, head of field operations and who really made all of this happen. And I'd like to really thank them for their legacy. So thank you.
We have time for maybe one question. Two questions. Any questions? Okay. But maybe at the end we'll just move on. Oh, yeah, sure. Sorry.
Dr. Zinnemann, thank you. So being that this is going to be the one question, maybe a little provocative. So I totally agree with your point around the success of GIST in being a prototype surveillance system. I wonder if you can stretch the boundaries of the database and kind of challenge oneself to ask, with all of that data, is there a way to utilize that to forecast where the resistance will emerge to extended spectrum cephalosporins or azithromycin?
I think that is a really good question. We've actually Ned Hook and I asked that question about 2 years ago. We went over this with some modelers, and unfortunately, with the data that we had at hand and the number of variables, we could not do that. However, but you're getting into a whole issue of predictive analytics, it's ripe for that. The problem is you don't know where the introduction patterns have been traditionally in the West, and I think you can look at the data of Cipro and Grodd's genomic data, basically ask the question, what's the trajectory of distribution of these organisms and so forth? And I think it's an open question, and I think it's something which really deserves to be asked and can be done with predictive analytics. You may end up with, people with the flu, in the flu area and other viral disease transmission areas do this type of stuff all the time.
Yep. No, thank you.